Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. Michael Laurie is pastor of the Highlands Baptist Church in Edmonton. He previously served a United Church. His move from a progressive form of Protestantism to the Evangelical Church is of particular interest for our conversations on the Ecclesia. Our conversation moves from his initial work in the United Church, his studies at Regent College, the Vancouver School of Theology, and Trinity Western University, touching briefly on his time with a peace ministry that went into the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Michael is the only person I have known who has met face-to-face with Ian Paisley, the militant Protestant leader central to the fractured society of Northern Ireland in the 1960s and following. We explore the Baptist idea of doctrinal purity, the attractional model of evangelical worship centered on one form or another of spectacle. What attracts people to this model? And what does it nurture in them? Has the pandemic ruptured this model of the church? Welcome to our conversation. You grew up in a home where your father was a United Church clergyman. And he served a United Church. And you also, as you reached maturity, served the United Church for a period of time. So you then migrated to the Baptist Church, and I've been very interested in your thoughts on a number of these steps since we first began talking to each other and I began to get to know you a bit. So I would like you to cast your mind back a little bit. When you began to serve in the United Church, can you piece together what you thought the church was? Were you taught anything about how the church thought about herself, or what was implicit in that? And let me be careful here. I'm trying to get at two things. One is, did you have any conceptual notion that you'd gotten from your education or from whatever the process was that led you there? And then I also want to look at your sense of what you came to see that it was. And then similarly, that leads to a kind of migration.
Mm-hmm.
So were you taught anything? What did you think the church was?
That's an interesting question, what I was taught, because my education was in the evangelical world, and yet I was a part of the United Church. And I think that's also what kind of framed my understanding of at least my role and my dad's role in the United Church, was to be a prophetic role, as to be within the church, calling it back to who it should be. I don't know if I necessarily understood who it should be, but the desire was to lift Christ up as Lord, that it seemed that within the United Church there was crazy ambiguity as to what does it mean to be the church, and particularly perplexing as a young person watching your dad. Because my dad, he became a pastor later in life in his 40s, and he worked as personnel management for federal government in the Okanagan College. And then in the United Church, he had this crazy charismatic experience during a Bible study where he was, to use the expression, slain by the Spirit and having a vision of holding the broken body of Christ in the tomb. And having this sense of three people behind him calling him into ministry, and then having an experience of a hot coal being put on his lips. And yet for my dad, who was biblically illiterate, like when my dad talked to the pastor about this, they said, oh, you must really like the book of Isaiah. My dad said, who is Isaiah? So there was this tangible sense of who Christ was. And I was very much confused as to what the church was doing, that the United Church seemed to have forgotten who Christ was. And so my calling into that ministry, it felt like, again, I was kind of taking up the anvil of kind of that, you know, family job, or in a sense of being to lift Christ up and to remind people of who Christ was.
And to remind the church.
And to remind the church.
The United Church, the local parish.
Yeah, which it was very, like, I had incredible mistrust for church leaders because of how they treated my family. Like, even after my dad's call experience and then being affirmed by the local United Church, the presbytery kept on trying to stop him from being pursuing ordination, because they're saying, well, you're too evangelical. Why do you keep talking about Jesus? You know, you don't fit here, which I found really perplexing. I was like, but if God's clearly called my dad into ministry, and yet the church leadership is blocking that and stopping that. To me, it felt it was that calling to continue to bring up that voice. And even when I was working as a youth pastor in the United Church, anytime I did any teaching, the comment that I would get the most is, well, this pastor sure seems to talk a lot about Jesus. I don't know about this. Or questioning should I be allowed within the United Church. Like, I went to the Vancouver School of Theology. I was enrolled in there, and I lasted 3 days there before I left. And it was just such a confusing time, particularly going from Trinity Western to VSD, where Trinity Western is very clear on what they believe and who they understand.
It's an evangelical school.
Yeah. And VST, where their language on God was very confusing. And when they were asking me to, as part of my studies, to lead worship with other students, and particularly this Wiccan priestess, and I just couldn't wrap my head around that one. And then when they were, when I talked about salvation and the need for repentance and the need to come into Christ and confessing him as Lord, there was a lot of ambiguity. Well, what do you mean by sin? What is sin? And so on. And I lasted 3 days there before I decided, you know, to leave. But it seemed that they were just, it's like, come to us and hopefully we can believe what you believe and we can make a place for you.
So both you and your father saw the United Church as a mission field.
Yeah.
Or, to use the language you used earlier, you saw yourself as prophet.
Yeah.
In these communities. You were calling them back. This is an old biblical theme. It's all shot through the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
The prophets trying to call people back. So you saw yourself trying to call people back. So implicit in that is some notion you did not see the United Church in this period, the United Church that you knew. You did not see it as the new Israel.
Definitely not. And one of the things that I struggled the most with was submitting to the authority of the church, when I knew that those who were in, you know, positions of leadership in the presbytery and the conference, I've listened in on the conversations where they said, oh, yeah, I lied during my ordination exams and told them I believed things that I didn't believe.
That, so what year was this about?
So this would have been 90... No, this would have been early 2000, 2002.
So, I mean, the United Church has gone through a fairly... a period of sea change, really, over the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. And there has fallen into the center of United Church self-definition a set of things where they, where the United Church was, or is this how you saw it? The United Church was trying to distance itself from the particularity of the Christian tradition. So the notions of the meaning of Jesus Christ as Savior, as the Incarnation, those have been largely downplayed through this period for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I think two examples I would have of that is the original Articles of Faith. I think it's the 20 Articles of Faith that the United Church developed, which was the bringing together the Congregational, Methodist, and Presbyterian. I think were quite beautiful and wonderful. And so I remember being interviewed, and they're saying, well, we don't think you fit within the United Church ethos. And I would shoot back and I say, I don't think you fit within the United Church ethos. I'm in a complete agreement with the Articles of Faith. You're not. And they say, well, we don't believe you have to be in agreement. You just have to be in essential agreement. But unfortunately, nobody ever defined what was essential. Mm-hmm. And then they moved towards creating a song of faith. And they basically, it was this, and rather than a new statement of faith, because they realized they couldn't get a plebiscite vote to change the original Articles of Faith, so they decided, well, we will just add this new updated statement of faith. But they couldn't agree on anything, so they used Song of Faith, and each verse seemed to have a different belief or a different thought that was kind of being claimed into it. And so that was definitely a grasping of trying to say, hey, we're open to all people come so that, we can be a part of it. I mean, I think the view was the population of the congregations was declining so quickly that they were desperate to include as many people. And then the other thing was, on the LGBT issue, which became, I think it was the first Protestant church in Canada to have, practicing LGBT people to be ordained ministers. And regardless of where you sit on that issue, and that divided the church, 25 years later, I was at a conference where they were celebrating that decision. And the person that was celebrating this decision for all of us and leading us in this conversation, he said, and that bold step allowed us to take other bold steps, such as questioning the divinity of Jesus and the authority of Scripture. And people were standing and applauding these kind of statements. So for myself, I definitely saw, I questioned the leadership, which also kind of put me out of sorts when I was in evangelical communities, because it seemed to be the unwritten rule is never question the pastor, never question the leadership. Yet in my experience in the United Church was always question the pastor, always question the leadership.
So you didn't last very long there.
Nor did 6 years.
Nor did your father.
Well, my dad, he lasted longer than I did. We kind of joked that I got fired faster than he did.
Yeah.
But, I mean.
And then you migrated.
Yeah. I mean, I think was something I didn't understand that the prophetic call means that you tell people a message, but expect them not to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, I would kind of look at it as, was it me getting pushed out? Was it me getting fired? Or was it God taking me out of that situation and placing me into a different situation. Mm-hmm. For my own sake of sanity, it makes it a lot easier to think that God was pulling me out of that context and bringing me into another context.
So the context you entered was a Baptist mm-hmm. conference, a Baptist church. Which Baptist communion?
So the Canadian Baptists of Western Canada, which would probably be known better by the Baptist Union, mm-hmm. But then later became Canadian Baptists of Western Canada.
Yeah. So when you entered and began to serve in the congregations in the Baptist Union, was there any, how would you characterize your understanding of the church? Or maybe it's better to even ask, what were your aspirations here? What was your hope here by making this kind of a move? And also, what did you find?
Well, I've often joked about how I was Baptist for the pay, in a sense of the kind of the unnervingness of being booted out of the United Church after 6 years, and those doors definitely being closed to me because I didn't go to United Church Seminary. And so it felt in some way like, hey, the Baptist community would be a better fit for me because I did my education at Trinity Western University, an evangelical university, and then I've been doing studies at Regent College in Vancouver and Axe Seminary in Langley at Trinity Western. So in my thinking, I thought we were it'd be more aligned and alike. But again, I guess what I was hoping for is, hey, I could finally lift Jesus up, articulate people or help our people understand and to come to understanding of who he is and not have the baggage of the leadership and being in disarray of the denomination.
So it wasn't going to be a fight.
It wasn't going to be a fight.
You thought they were on the same page as you?
Yeah, I assumed we were on the same page. Mm-hmm. But I quickly discovered that even though we were on the same page, we were not. It's like every denomination seems to be able to pick sides and split on who's on which side and stuff like that. And particularly my experience with charismatic people and listening prayer, hearing God, and the expectation of God to move and stuff like that definitely put me kind of to the sideline within the denomination, like at the Baptist orientation, pastor's orientation, which I think also, this is interesting, it's a 3-day orientation seminar, and that's all you get to be orientated to be a Baptist pastor.
What's the focus of that orientation?
Really, the focus was on here is our policies and procedures on conduct. Here are the resources available for you to grow as a leader, because to provide educational resources and grant money, and then an introduction to who are the different leaders within the denomination. I remember this interesting story where, again, yeah, as I would go up, people would come up to me and say, oh, so you're the pastor who says that you think you can hear God. And which to me, I was really kind of struggled with, because I thought, aren't we past this? We're an evangelical church. Don't we believe that God does speak? Yeah, you should expect that. And there was this activity where we were doing some kind of thing with one of the professors, and our group won, and we ended up getting a cash prize. It was like $40 or something like that. And they asked us, so what are we going to do with it afterwards? And I said, well, we're going to the bar, which got all the Baptists uptight and stuff like that. I said, no, 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 no. We we're going to go and we're going to tip big. We're going to give that money as a tip to bless someone. And it was really quite interesting the next day when people asked, what did we do with the money and why didn't we buy Timbits or donuts to bring them in? And I explained how a bunch of us went to this pub, and one of the guys that was with us, one of the pastors, met one of his old youth group kids there. And they were explaining to that they had run out of money. Their car was empty on gas. They didn't know how they were going to make ends meet. And by the end of the night, we gave her like a $300 tip to bless her.
Which included the $40.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that really, it was just, I mean, as I shared that story, everyone really looked really perplexed at me. And I'm like, isn't Jesus great? Isn't that just like the way to kind of go about it? And I kind of also saw that it was just more of the local church is concerned, at least in the Baptist kind of view of how do we impact our community and how do we attract people to come, and particularly in youth ministry where the model seemed to be, do some kind of crazy event to bring kids in. Like we would have a Halloween thing where it was the pumpkin Olympics, where we would have kids come and bring pumpkins, and then we'd carve the pumpkins and we'd take all the pumpkin guts, and then we'd put the pumpkin guts in these big buckets with candies, and then the kids would have to bob for candy and that. And then we had a 12-foot trebuchet built out in the parking lot, and we had competitions who could fling their pumpkin the furthest and so on. And then afterwards, you'd hope to kind of talk to about Jesus somehow in that way.
I see.
Yeah. it was, I mean, hey, it got people to show up. But it was interesting for me as I started to shift in my thinking where, instead of doing these games and these activities, I started introducing the kids into praying for each other. And I started doing this thing where I started with like, hey, let's pray for each other. And instead of me just praying, I would say, hey, you know, Sally, can you pray? Or Mark, can you pray for this person? And then the next week I would say, are there any answered prayers? And then people would come up and give testimony of how God answered that prayer. And then it became kind of a thing where the games, I was able to kind of push the games aside, and people were just sharing their heart and what was going on with their life with following God and what's going on and praying for each other. And it was a really quite wonderful experience. But within the Baptists, one of the things that they definitely hold to is the purity of doctrine. But no one ever defined the doctrine. Each church is allowed to define its own doctrine. And the moment that you start to question or don't fit within that doctrine, it's amazing how quickly the people can turn against you, because of the Protestant roots of, you know, having a proper understanding of Scripture and so on. But and then we would do other things like the big church Christmas event. We would put on a big Christmas play. And we'd spend like months working on and turn the sanctuary into a set. And it was a 50s diner. And I was supposed to play this guy that kind of resembled a DJ / Fonzie from Happy Days. And
now you're the pastor.
I'm the youth pastor.
You're the youth pastor, so you're going to be Fonz.
Yes. Fonzie. Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, the idea was that people would be able to invite in it their neighbors to the service. And then there would be like a altar call kind of experience at the end of the thing.
Because you channeled this very famous television program from the 50s.
Yes.
To the 60s.
Yeah. So, there'd be a number of shows and, you know, people would fill the seats out and stuff like that. Although I would really question it, because I always just like, and they, people would say, hey, look, we got, you know, two people wrote back and said that they, you know, decided to start coming to church because of this. And yet I was like, oh my goodness, how many hours did I spend on this and this extra energy and this stress? And I usually ended up in the hospital, or not the doctor's office, with some stress illness because I'm trying to do all this stuff. But I also found it amazing how the church seemed to just so easily buy into this, that people is like, well, this is how I'm going to serve God. I'm going to build a set, or I'm going to bring my musical gifts here, or I'm going to, you know, cook cookies to hand out to the stuff. Like, this is the, you know, the evangelism engine of the church. So instead of throwing pumpkins around in youth group, now with adults, we're putting on a play to attract people to attend and to participate.
A play which mimics the 50s or the 60s and mm-hmm. gives it a kind of spiritual patina.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, and we did that once, and then we did there was a part two of that play, and then it got bigger, and we had caterers coming in and meals. I think we did five different shows and stuff like that. And then peculiar things like, oh, we'd do stuff for Valentine's Day and having like couples come and doing different games and activities for couples to do. And one of the things that I kind of found peculiar about this is like, I'm only noticing people that are actually a part of the church coming to these events. I never actually meet people outside of the church to take part in these events. And yet there was this view or this belief, acceptance that you provide these activities and then, you know, you'll get people in the church. Like, one of them was a guy who used to own a bakery, and his bakery, before he closed it, was famous for cinnamon buns. And so he invited the community to come, and he would teach them how to make cinnamon buns. Apparently, 200 people showed up. It was a complete, you know, gong show and stuff like that. And yet, people are like, oh, wasn't that great outreach? And I'd be really quite perplexed to be like, I'm really not sure what outreach was, but a lot of people learned how to make cinnamon buns.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. Especially if they use lots of butter.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we've talked about just a little bit, and I wanted to revisit, you have paid attention to what is happening in at least a part of the evangelical world. You have attended conferences in the United States that have been put on by various evangelical organizations, including Bill Hybels' organization. And you have watched as some large mega churches developed in this period. You have been thinking about what is at the center of their preoccupations. So describe for me initially, so we can talk about it, how this movement within the evangelical world, this church movement, comes to have a certain kind of spectacle, a certain kind of entertainment, a certain kind of show at its center.
Yeah.
Describe that a little bit.
Well, it was interesting how the Willow Creek Association, which was what Bill Hybels kind of started, and it I first encountered it when I was in the United Church, and then continuing on in the Baptist Church, and they'd hold these leadership summits where the best and the brightest of the Christian and the business world would tell us on how to lead. And like lemmings, we would buy all their books. And like, my goodness, it was crazy to the number of books that would be, you know, sold on different leadership techniques and so on.
So this is leadership techniques largely coming from the business world.
Yeah.
Which sometimes pastors pick up on it, or other church leaders pick up on it, do versions of it, which give it a kind of religious patina as well.
Yeah.
And root it in what they think the church ought to be doing.
Yes.
And how pastors ought to be moving forward.
And because their churches were big and successful, we just believe they must be right. Because God always blesses big and successful. Which I've, yeah, realized it's not the case. But I think part of it was just also out of desperation that no one, whether in the United Church or in the Baptist Church, had a clear idea what it is we were trying to do. And someone was offering something, and it looked successful, and it helped deal with these questions. But the thing that I found really troublesome in that whole process is it put all the pressure on the pastor, and the pastor utilizing their leadership gifts to grow the church. And if the church wasn't growing, well, obviously, it was a failing of the pastor, which created a wonderful guilt and shame complex. And these churches found a model of, it was a attractional model, or come and see. Seeker sensitivity was...
Attractional. You create an attraction.
Yeah. And so...
Seeker
sensitivity.
Seeker sensitivity.
So we will dumb down our Christian practices so that the pagan won't feel out uncomfortable when we practice them. And definitely adopting a music style that uses the same sound and communication method as the contemporary music. Although I would say we don't do it as well. Christian music's never as good. Although I think it did really meet a need that there was a generation that needed a new hymn book to be able to communicate in a language that we understood. But I think, unfortunately, the music ended up taking over the show, and kind of forgetting what was the point of the service. And so all of a sudden you would have services, and I've seen these manuals where, you know, they would tell you how to stand in a certain pattern when people are coming in so that no one can actually get into the church without being greeted by so many people to be made welcome. Information desks in the foyer, free coffees if you sign up to for the membership list and so on. And, everyone that was a believer understood, well, leave the best seats for the new people, you know, to come. And the music was done in a way that definitely, you know, sounded similar to what they would hear on a radio, but then
this mimics rock music and
rock music, yeah, you know, electric guitar and all that, which I myself really appreciate. Although it's interesting how some of that music became to sound, there seemed to be a deficit within that music of, rather than singing about who God was, they were more singing about our neediness and how we need God and we long for God and we want God. And a lot of songs like Come and Fill Me Up, and just kind of chanting that over, but never actually kind of moving on to who it is that we're actually worshiping and who we are, getting ready to kind of come to and listen to. And then it evolved into, well, there's different generations. So we would have louder music for the youth, and we would have smoke machines and trying to create this atmosphere and this energy. And it seemed like I know some churches that have 7 different types of services with all different flavors. It's the same speaker, but it's interesting how, you know, you'd have a country western service and they have a contemporary worship, and then you'd have a hardcore rock one where you can't hear it, but you can feel the music, and so on. And the drive was to get people to attend and communicate it in a way that is received. Sermons became more motivational speakers. I think Rick Warren, who wrote that book, Purpose Driven Life, really described well within COVID. He's saying the churches that are demanding to get back to open and have services are the churches that only have Sunday morning to offer. And that he was saying his church, they're a different model and so on, but definitely more focused on small group discipleship. And they started running pop-up food banks in communities and ended up having a huge outreach. And they're saying like 6,000 people came to the Lord through just offering food for hungry people. So he says, we're doing fine without having our main service, but if all you have to offer is Sunday morning and the music and attracting people, then you're in real trouble when you can't offer that.
So during COVID, the attractions all had to be on Zoom.
Yeah, which is
not quite as attractive.
It's just not. Yeah. And interesting how I would see certain, within the Christian music or worship scene, there's different streams of music. There's Hillsong, there's Bethel, there's Worship Together. Worship Together kind of is a group from the UK. Hillsong is Australia and the United States. And Bethel is from this Bethel Church in California, which is a charismatic church. And they seem to kind of corner the market on worship music. And over Christmas, they were advertising their Christmas services. And they were, instead of calling it like Christmas service, they were calling it like our Christmas spectacle or Christmas celebration spectacle and stuff like that. And watching this, and these people would, you would think it was Cirque du Soleil came and did church to these different events. And again, it was like anything that we can do to attract, tickle the eyes, entice people to come, and with the hope that they might say the sinner's prayer, which I guess, that really is the evangelical hope, which I say is, well, that's just the starting point to be able to say, hey, Jesus, I need you in my life. I confess that that I'm a sinner and I need you. And I think that's where the evangelical kind of falls short. We're really good at getting people to say that prayer, but really bad at follow-up.
So, as you described briefly, that kind of sort of worship music, as it's called, mm-hmm. which is, you suggested this, which is all about my need. Mm-hmm. All about my need. There's an old evangelical tradition here. It goes back to the revivalist tent meetings, mm-hmm. Where the emphasis, where what is being called forth is one's own passions, mm-hmm. one's own despair, one's own sense of guilt and one's own fears, where that is being called forth. I don't know the contemporary music scene. It's one of my many, many limitations. But the little bit I have heard, I do occasionally listen to some of this, particularly if I'm traveling somewhere in order to try and get a sense of what's going on in the culture. It seems to me, and again, I'm ignorant of this, but it seems to me that this is music which is very, very good at calling forth human passions,
mm-hmm.
calling forth human desires, calling forth anger, calling forth sometimes even hatred, and calling forth the deep longing of human beings for some kind of visceral catharsis,
mm-hmm.
some kind of visceral catharsis. So are you suggesting that much of this worship music is shaped to actually do that? That's what its purpose is to call forth and bring one to a kind of visceral catharsis rooted in one's own passions.
Well, I want to be careful on this because I do appreciate a lot of that music, and for myself, I appreciate that. But I think a lot of the music is reflective of the maturity of those who write it. That their own experience of God doesn't extend beyond that emotional response. And I think, and this will sound harsh, but it's easier to formalize a worship experience where to push those emotions and to have that emotional release or that emotional connection is a lot easier than trusting that the Holy Spirit is going to show up and touch people's hearts. And I think it gets confused that those emotional moments, and particularly when they incorporate that with the, you know, the call to people to come up for prayer and so on and afterwards. But I think what happens is it almost becomes like a drug or a habit forming where you need to come back for your next hit so that you feel close to God, because there's always that coming down and so on. And it's like, well, maybe I didn't pray hard enough. Maybe I didn't worship hard enough. Or maybe if I go to this worship conference or with this band in such and such, there might be a certain anointing on that I can finally break free on what it's going on in my life. And it becomes kind of like chasing the experience rather than pursuing the maker or the creator or coming to know who Jesus is. So I think the music, to me, music is amoral, but it's how you use it and utilize it. And there seems to be a sense of worship leaders do their thing, pastors do their thing, but they never really communicate with each other. And there's no real teaching of what is the flow of worship? What does it mean to come into the presence of God? Are there, like, I think from my own experience, I've learned a lot from utilizing and looking at the flow of liturgy, how it takes you to that place to receive Eucharist, to hear the preaching or the teaching. And the process of the liturgy helps you get ready to listen to that. And I found it helpful to incorporate the music to do the same thing that liturgy is doing. But if someone has a song and it goes to the top 40, all of a sudden they're the mainstream worship leader and they're now holding conferences and they're telling people how to lead worship. But all they did is have a good song. And now they are the voice that is defining worship. And I think we're seeing a number of Christian worship leaders who are now saying, well, I don't believe this anymore. You know, they're saying they got caught up into this whole experience and this agenda and corporation of promoting music and trying to sell things. I mean, one of the things that I found interesting is the few times that I've taken part in, like, businesses, when they put on conferences and they have, like, you know, trying to get everyone rah, rah, rah about this corporation and stuff like that, the similarities between a business conference and a Sunday morning are very similar. That same kind of style and so on. I remember being at this one thing at the Space Needle, and I remember hearing the people in charge saying, okay, let's play the music that we played for this group while they were doing the work back in the summer, so they remember that. Okay, now do we have the ice cream sandwiches that we gave them as treats back in the summer? Let's bring that out so that will help them remember and trigger those kind of memories and so on. Hillsong's Church, they have these outdoor gatherings in Australia where they have a barbecue on wheels. And it's rolled around where everyone else is singing and stuff like that, so you can pick a stick of meat, a barbecued meat off, and eat that while you're at worship. It's crazy.
You also have mentioned to me a little bit about some of the mega churches which make use of this spectacle,
mm-hmm.
that's the central thing that they do together. Every worship service is a highly orchestrated show.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a performance.
Yeah, it is. Like, to thinking of what is the person's experience going to be in the parking lot? Do we have the right parking attendants so that first time people can get to parking easily, and that they'd have certain parking set aside for first time attenders? When they come into the foyer, are they welcomed? Is there appropriate signage to direct them to, you know, what's going on? When they come in, what is their going to be experience? And, and everyone buys into this idea that if you are a Christian and you're part of the service, then you're playing a role in this. So either you are a parking lot attendant, you are a greeter, or if you're not a greeter, you better dang well welcome people when they sit down and say hello, and so on. And the discipleship becomes involvement in the church and putting on the show. Which was interesting, though, with the Heibel's stuff, because they did a bunch of research and then they found out that just being involved in the church doesn't mean discipleship. It just means that you're really involved with the church. But there was this kind of belief that, well, if you can get these people to be involved in all these different activities for the church, then they're growing in their faith. And then to realize, no, they're not actually. They're just, you know, really busy. And conversations have changed as to how we do announcements, you know, on Sunday morning. Where do you put the announcements? What are the first songs that we're going to start off with? What is the sound level going to be like? What are the images? It's not enough just to have the images on the screen. Now we have to have motions, movement behind the screen. Offering gifts to first-time visitors to sign up afterwards. It's all these different events and so on, and that was viewed as discipleship, is to be involved with that. But as far as equipping people to live their life as a faithful follower of Jesus in their context, at work, as with their neighbors, and so on, wasn't encouraged. And I think COVID has really revealed that the real mission field is in your neighborhood with your neighbor. How do you connect with them? How do you actually live your faith? Too many courses have been offered on how to share your faith and to give people the right apologetic answers, rather than, hey, why don't you bake some cookies and just drop them off to your neighbor and say hello?
So the large box churches, which have as their central liturgy this show,
mm-hmm.
They also have, usually they're located in suburban areas, areas where cities are developing. Often they come, they're professionals that come in and work with city planners, see where these new neighborhoods are going to be, who's going to be in them, what's their economic, what's the scale of their their income, things of that nature. And then they they build their mega church there. Sometimes these are gated neighborhoods. Sometimes they aren't formally gated, but informally so, because the income that's necessary to live there is fixed. So it's not a community of diversity, certainly not economic diversity of any sort. So one of the things they've also done is they've taken and arranged their churches so that there are a series of cell groups. And these cell groups have a role to play. What's that role?
Well, the view of the pastor, or they have like, it's interesting how the terms have changed. And rather than minister, it's now, there's the administrative pastor or executive pastor, who would be someone who's got the gifts for administration and basically running the machine of the church, all the staff and everything that needs to kind of take place. And then you'd have your teaching pastor or your senior pastor, whose really focus is to do the Sunday morning preaching and teaching. But the pastoral care aspect is then downloaded onto small groups and small group leaders, where the recognition, hey, we're so big that we're not actually going to get to know everyone. So let's have our paid leadership focus with our key volunteers and equipping and building those people up in their leadership gifts. And also let's equip these small group leaders to provide these pieces of community to kind of gather, to connect. A church thinks it's successful if they can get 60% of their church involved in a small group kind of a setting.
If you have 1,000 members or 5,000 members or 20,000 members, that's quite a few people.
Yeah. As far as the, but what actually takes place, I mean, there's one church that I thought did a good well, is that they would base the, each week the group would work off what the sermon was, conversations, stuff like that, so that the only preparation that you needed was to listen to the sermon. And again, everyone was kind of on the same page.
And so they listened to the sermon, then the following week it'd be digested.
Yeah.
And talked about.
Yeah. But a lot of other churches, where there will, some popular writer's book will then be turned into a small group series, and then that popular writer will come up with so many, like a 10-minute video blurb for each chapter, and so on, which is a great resource because a lot of people don't take the time to read. And I've run small groups where I've seen a couple driving up and one person is reading the chapter that we're going to talk about in the car in the parking lot and going on. But in some ways, I think it really stymies the really building the authentic connection, because you're not actually asking people, unlike the Methodist, you know, kind of view of like asking, getting together, how are you doing? You know, where did you make it past the gin joint this week, and actually knowing each other? It's these questions that have been, you know, formatted, and the leadership isn't necessarily a leader anymore. It's just, are you willing to host people and press play on a DVD and allow the DVD to kind of do the discussion and so on?
Well, you've used the language of equipping. A lot of the language that you've used to illustrate this is really the language of business and technology. Of techniques. So let's look at it from the other end. You've spoken about that main event as the attraction. Why are people coming? I mean, because these large churches have become quite popular. Why do people come? What are they looking for? Or what's the attraction?
What is the attraction? One of the things that I've come to realize that will determine the if your church is an attractional church is if you have a strong kids program. Particularly for young families, if you can put them off into some kind of Sunday school program, then you know that they'll be taken care of. That's really important.
So it gives the parents a couple hours.
Giving the parents a couple hours. There's that sense of, hey, we need to protect ourselves from secular society. So being a part of this larger church and this larger community will provide the programs and the activities that I can kind of steer my kids towards to, protect them from what is going on. And when I was a youth pastor, I definitely felt that pressure. They're saying, well, why aren't you doing more all-nighters? And like that's where you have all the kids come in and all night and you stay up all night and you do stupid stuff with them. And I'd say, well, no, because I don't see how that helps promote the gospel. but it keeps my kids away from drinking or doing other stuff. And so it's like, well, I think that's actually more of a conversation that you should have with your kids than me. And so in some way, it's like handing it off to professionals, viewed as professionals to raise their kids and so on. And then I think that there are actual people who are really soul-seeking, trying to figure out. They've had some kind of experience in their life and that this big church is big and successful, so it just seems kind of natural to kind of attend that church. But according to the numbers, big churches don't actually create new followers of Jesus. They collect followers of Jesus from other churches. Uh-huh. And that,
we call it the circulation of the saints.
Yeah, the circulation of the saints. And then so a lot of these bigger churches are, I know they're talking about this with the Alliance Church in the States. These big Alliance mega churches are sucking up all of the Alliance members of the smaller churches, and that's going to keep them going for another generation. But after that, they're going to be in trouble because they're not actually drawing new believers into the church. But for someone who has been in a smaller church where you feel like you're doing everything. I've heard people say, well, it'd just be so much easier to go to Easy Church where you show up, someone takes your kids, they register your kids so you can sit, you know, good speaker, good music. I can collect my kids afterwards and then we can go home.
And we're able to manage another week.
Yeah.
And we haven't been in an environment where anything is challenging us beyond what we're accustomed to and what we really believe in.
Yes. I remember my wife and I often joke, and she's joked about this, and saying, I would never make it as a mega church pastor because I don't look the part. I don't have the tattoos. I'm too overweight to wear a tight t-shirt and don't have stories of, you know, being a sinner from my past. And that seems to be kind of like the outline that they want these pastors to be. It's like they're either like an athlete or a hunter and they have some kind of crazy story, which kind of creates the attraction and kind of fill the void. And I find it interesting when I ask people about their church, they tell me how entertaining the pastor is and how passionate the pastor is. And he tells such great stories about life before he was a Christian. And I always find that just very interesting. It's like, What about the body of Christ and the believers and encouraging and building one another up? That doesn't exist. It's the entertainment of the speaking.
Michael, you've got you've come to a perspective on this. And where does your sense of your ministry and of what the church is, how does that sit for you now? What is you? You have a small, modest congregation. You have generously invited me there several times, and I've talked with some of those people. I'm quite charmed by it, mm-hmm. in the sense that it seems to be what I would call a wholesome place. Mm. A wholesome place. And a modest place. I certainly have no sense that there's a spectacle going on there. So you've come through, you know, a number of years of being in these different contexts, thinking about what is actually going on in the church. We've recently been in this pandemic, and that's highlighted a number of things pretty mm-hmm. vividly and raised a whole bunch of questions within all kinds of clergy mm-hmm. about whether the church is sustainable in the way in which it's been doing things, or is there something we could draw from this, something we can learn from it? So, not in direct, I don't mean to ask this in direct reference to the pandemic, but as you've surveyed this and looking at your own church and how you are going about that work there, what do you see the church as, this little parish as, and where are you in it, and what does what you do, what does that, what's the place of that?
Yeah.
How does that look? What's the place of it in it?
The picture of the church that I hold on to is a water station on a marathon right now, where people are running the race and you're there to offer a cup of cold water, refreshment, encouragement, and cheering them on to keep running the race. And part of that, developing that was even just for my own mental health, because I would get so filled with anxiety and depressed that I'd say, I'm obviously failing as a Christian leader because my church isn't growing. But I needed to come to that place of recognizing, wait a minute, Jesus said he was the head of the church. Jesus said he would build my church. So my job isn't to build the church. My job is to be a faithful shepherd of the church. And I've been encouraged by, at least within our denomination, a number of conversations. I don't know where it will go, but they were saying that COVID has revealed that the attractional model is broken in it. And basically we need to move past that. What COVID has revealed to me, and I think what we were already doing, is people want to be known. And if we can create an environment where there is that sense of being known and someone cares about you, is so important. And not just about what's going on in their life, but what's going on in their soul. And to encourage them and walk with them. One of the things that I have learned is, as a pastor, it's not my job to fix the community. it's not my job to offer some program that I can promote to the neighborhood and that will help all these people be better parents or better, you know, married couples and so on. My job is to be present and listen with those people and make them feel, help them feel known and cared for. And in that process, help reveal who God's heart for them and encouraging them to pursue the gifting that God's given them in whatever context that it is. And one of the things that I learned is to allow things to fall in the church and not rush to fix them and see who with gifts might step in to do that. Mm. Not try to organize things too much, like in giving freedom to people of just, hey, during COVID, we've had some people who've passed away. And I've been remarked on how people within our congregation got together and arranged on their own to have meals dropped off to these different families. And the pastor had nothing to do with it. And yet I've heard from other churches with the bigger churches, and they have this whole ministry of meals, but then the person who's in charge of that is away for vacation, but someone dies, and the pastors don't have the keys, they don't know who it is and how to get these meals to anyone, and it's like a total schmozzle. And so just letting people to exercise their gifts and not trying to twist arms and convince them, hey, I need you to come alongside and help build what we have here on Sunday morning, and being okay with the gifts that are offered to be used. Our Sunday mornings are not a spectacle. The worship is different every Sunday. But one of the things that I have appreciated is when the people that have come to our church that are new, they said that someone saw me here and I wasn't looked past or ignored. And I think in an age of social media where people don't really have real connection anymore, that's so, so important. And I think it's adjusted my thinking of the, it's not about getting people to pray the sinner's prayer anymore. It's getting people to come to the realization that they are created in the image of God. God has called and gifted them to reflect his love and beauty and mercy to the world. And how do I help them discover that and pursue that in their context? Like I remember thinking, oh, maybe we should try to focus on small group growth when we get out of COVID, and particularly, you know, the young men's group. And then I found out a friend of mine, he bought a new hot rod. He loves hot rods. And he's invited a whole bunch of guys to come over to his garage and work on the hot rod. And he says, the hot rod is not really important. I just want to create space for people, guys, to share. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is a beautiful small group.
And it gives a whole new meaning to the rod of Aaron.
Yeah.
Doesn't it?
So it's not fancy. It's not fast. Do I still get, anxiety when I see other churches doing really well and there are great numbers and stuff like that? Yeah. But at the end of the day, I'm trying to be faithful to who Jesus has called me to do in this particular context and trust that he will reveal it as I go, and not have my vision or mission that is defining that, and mm-hmm. just allowing what to come up comes up.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Michael has come to understand his pastoral work as modest, a quiet nurturing of God's heart for all people. He seeks to be a midwife to the varied gifts within his congregation. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.